Call this meeting the House Resources Committee to order. In attendance, we have Representatives Capsner, Gatto, Olson, Ramis, Samuel, Seaton, Elkins, and Crawford. Today, we are going to get some feedback on the paper we put out, which had the major points on the changes to HB 488. The CS that we're having drafted, we got back from the legislative drafter. We're having the original drafter of the bill, Mr. Mins, go through and review that, and then they will be working with Mr. Chenoweth and Ledge Legal. So maybe by this afternoon, maybe by tomorrow morning, as soon as we get it out, we will get it out, but I just don't want to get it out in advance. Because of, which leads into my next point, we put some numbers in the white paper that were out yesterday, and I was reminded of this by every oil company and by a couple of different reporters, that one of the percentages was not exactly correct. And I should have stuck with my original language, which said approximately, and I did not do that, and for that I apologize.
Which percentage?
Don't want to go there. With that, we have invited at the beginning of this process, before we had any testimony whatsoever for the very first day of this testimony, HB 48, we had given a commitment to the producers as well as the explorers that they would have a chance to come back after the CS was put in and give their comments on what the changes were made, and we'd like to live up to that commitment. The schedule as we go down the road is to try to get to the amendments tomorrow. If we can get the bill out tomorrow, we'll see how many amendments go. We'll see what the testimony brings today, and we'll kind of see how it goes from here. Tomorrow we will have a meeting one way or another to meet at 12:30. And with that, on the agenda for today, we're going to start with Mr. Wenzel with Conoco, followed by Pat Foley with Pioneer, Mr. Hanley with Anadarko, Mr. Walker and Williams with BP, John Zager will be on teleconference from Chevron Unocal, Mr. Hansforth with Talisman Energy out of Alberta will be on teleconference. And I believe that Richard Owen from Exxon is also going to be presenting today also. So we'll kind of see how when he shows up. So with that, we'd like to start with Brian Wenzel, the Vice President of Finance and Administration with ConocoPhillips Alaska. Online to answer any questions is Robert Mintz with the Department of Law, Robin Wilson with the Tax Division, and Mr. Zager and Hanforth, as I mentioned earlier. And we've also been joined by Representative Ledoux. So with that, Mr. Wenzel.
Thank you. Co-Chairman Samuels, Ramirez, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Brian Wenzel. I'm the Vice President of Finance and Administration at ConocoPhillips Alaska. I'd like to present ConocoPhillips' views on this committee's proposed changes to House Bill 488. Based on the substantive changes document that was handed out yesterday at the meeting of this committee, the committee substitute you are working on is going to have a negative impact on the attractiveness of Alaska for ConocoPhillips' investment dollars. ConocoPhillips absolutely opposes this CS and any proposal that increases our industry's taxes beyond the $1 billion per year proposed by the governor. The proposal before us, the proposal that seems to be summarized by the substantial changes document, increases oil taxes by an average of $1.8 billion if today's prices continue. This is a total of $18 billion over the next 10 years. The approach reflected in this committee substitute is clearly to maximize state revenue in the short term while putting at risk long-term production, state revenue, jobs for Alaskans, and the growth of the private sector. The CS you are considering destroys the balance in that original bill. We realize that you have come to this conclusion after listening to the testimony from several of your consultants. If we understand the consultant's testimony, they are suggesting that you can jettison the balance of the original proposal and adopt an approach like that reflected in the CS with no adverse effect on investment. Indeed, they suggest that you may actually increase investment in the state by doing so. We also have hired a number of consultants, and we will use their input as we lay out for the House and Senate Finance Committees the same points that we were unsuccessful in demonstrating to you. However, at the end of the day, neither your consultants nor ours must make or live with the decision that's currently before the Alaska State Legislature. Similarly, none of the consultants ever has or ever will make an investment decision on behalf of ConocoPhillips. To the extent that your consultants are telling you that the CS you are considering will not have a negative impact on ConocoPhillips' investment decisions going forward, I can tell you, I must tell you, they are absolutely wrong. It will have an impact. Taking billions of dollars out of our industry will have a negative impact on investment. Taking away a significant portion of the upside potential in a basin with long lead times of a decade or more, in an area with low prospectivity, and with higher costs than almost any other place in the world, this will negatively affect investment and consequently affect production, state revenues, and jobs. This is a natural consequence of the action you are taking. Moreover, the negative effect on our decision-making and on the decision-making of others will not result just from the increased tax burden you are seeking to impose. Rather, there is also a question of our and others' confidence in the future investment climate here in the state. Adverse changes to the key parameters of the originally proposed bill will result in a fundamental shift of the risks and rewards for investments in Alaska. Unreasonable changes, like those included in the CS, will cause not only ConocoPhillips, but also other investors to question not whether, but when Alaska will again change its fiscal regime and impose an unfair, unreasonable burdens on those who have taken great risks and invested billions of dollars to help develop the state's resources. It's irrelevant whether the future change will come in the form of a change in the state's production tax, its property tax, its state corporate income tax, or in the creation of entirely new tax. The point is that investors will now need to consider another significant risk in making their economic decisions in Alaska, the risk that Alaska will not approach future fiscal policy changes in a reasonable manner that recognizes the commitment and contribution that companies like ConocoPhillips have made. As an example of the type of thinking that will negatively affect potential future investors' view of Alaska, ConocoPhillips has received a letter this morning from Representative Guerra and Senator French concerning our recent media ads. If you haven't received a copy of that letter, I'm happy to share it with you. But the letter suggests that somehow the private sector company profits are bad, that state government has not shared in the benefit of higher oil prices, that our commitment to long-term investment in Alaska, one of the largest of any company anywhere in the world, is essentially irrelevant. We disagree with each of these suggestions. The antipathy toward the industry expressed in this letter is what concerns us most about the current debate on oil taxes. It has become for some an exercise in seeing how much the state can take from the private sector for no other reason simply to take more. Unfortunately, this CS is structured to take more from the very industry participants that are most committed to Alaska's future. According to the substantive changes document, you have changed nearly every key parameter in the original bill in a one-sided way that benefits the state and is at the expense of ConocoPhillips and other major North Slope producers. You have destroyed the balance that was previously presented in the bill. Through the CS, you propose to further increase the PPT tax rate on the industry via a surcharge at high prices, in effect a windfall profits tax. At current prices, the additional surcharge will more than triple the effective tax rate over the current system. This is essentially another $1 billion per year at today's prices on top of the $1 billion already raised by the original proposal. This change is neither fair nor reasonable to current investors, will be viewed as unreasonable and unfair by potential future investors. You have severely reduced the intended transition plan that investors with large recent capital investment projects, which many of which aren't even producing yet, are penalized for apparently investing in Alaska too early and being too optimistic about the future of Alaska. Let me emphasize that. This CS penalizes the very companies that have been investing, creating jobs, and building the resource base here in the state of Alaska. You've extended the statutory exploration tax credits available to explorers, but as one of the few companies who've actually applied for credits under this current statute, our experience is that, in fact, the current regulation effectively reduces the value of those credits to 70% or less of their stated value. Further, these credits only affect about 4% of the Department of Revenue's expected future sources of production and investment in Alaska. You have reduced by over 30% the effective value of the base allowance, which is intended to encourage small explorers and new entrants. You have moved the effective date of this bill back to a completely impractical date. The necessary regulations and procedures and computer systems cannot possibly be adopted by April 1st of this year, which means that production taxpayers in Alaska will have to guess at their tax liability, make unsupported payments of tax in an uncertain attempt to avoid punitive interest costs. And you've suggested a punitive interest penalty of 5% on top of a statutory rate of 11%, which obviously already includes a punitive element. In our view, these changes from the original bill are completely inconsistent with the goals of a fair and reasonable fiscal policy, increased long-term investment in Alaska, and a vibrant and secure Alaska oil industry. We urge you to reconsider the long-term impact of this bill on the future of the state of Alaska. We urge you not to move this bill out of this committee until it can be recrafted with a more balanced and long-term perspective. Thank you for considering our views.
Thank you, Mr. Wenzel. Any questions for Mr. Wenzel? Representative Rammers.
I just want to thank you for your thoughtful and sensitive testimony.
Thank you, Representative Rammers.
I have a question.
Representative Kapsner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you have a copy of the letter that Representative Guerra and Senator French distributed to you or sent to you?
Through the chair, Representative Kapsner, yes, I do. I'd be happy to provide you a copy after the meeting if you'd like.
That'd be great, or even during the meeting. When you were in my office yesterday morning along with Michael Hurley, both of you conceded that the industry recognized that it was time to make a change in taxes, and you conceded this isn't something that we do every year or every other year. This is once in a great while. So I do have concerns with the ads that you're running, giving the public the perception that redoing a tax is just completely unthinkable.
Through the chair, Representative Kapsner. I think the point of our ads is that as we see where the legislature seems to be going and hear the questions and see the CS summaries, our concern is that there is not a balanced and reasonable approach here, but rather there seems to be more of a tax and spend type approach. And
so you did the commercials after you heard about the CS changes?
Through the chair, Representative Kapsner, no. The commercials were done before. But again, many of these questions have been coming along. The CS has not yet been released.
Yeah.
But again, as we have said to you before and as we've represented in testimony before this committee, the bill that was proposed originally we viewed as a balanced proposal. It was a hard pill for us to swallow. We accepted it as a balanced way to move forward such that we could move forward not only with our future oil investments but also with the gas pipeline. To us it seemed like the right balance, even though on a standalone basis it would have been much more than we could accept.
Okay. Another thing that we talked about was the feeling from the industry standpoint that the bill that we received from the administration was an end product. And as a person in this branch of government, I think that it's pretty far-reaching to expect 60 members of the legislature who are elected to represent their own communities to just say, oh, well, this is what the governor decided. Okay, well, that sounds great. He must have, you know, considered everything, and our work is done here. In my ninth grade civics class, we learned there are three branches of government. The legislature appropriates the budget, sets taxes, makes laws, and the governor signs the laws and upholds the laws. But I feel that it is definitely within our purview to take a look at the governor's product, and you know, I think that it's just insulting to a large degree to think that we should just say, well, our work is done here before we look at and take into consideration what the consultant said. Every consultant that's been before us has said 25-20 is a good starting point.
Mm-hmm.
Through the chair, Representative Kapsner. I don't think any of us have actually come to you and said that you should not debate the issues, that you should not consider all the issues related to this bill and the investment in Alaska in the future and the needs for state revenues. In fact, I think we approached with our original testimony and said we recognize and we still recognize the sovereignty of this legislature and the need for this legislature to set fiscal policy and approve law. Our hope was that by testifying before this committee and by visiting many of you privately, that we could help to take you through the same process that we've been through before, and you would come to the same balanced view of the future in terms of how best to both meet the state's needs, but also to meet the need of growing this industry, of fostering additional investment in the oil industry here in Alaska. And so it was not that we presented with you with a fait accompli or a mandate, this is the only answer, but rather we had hoped that you, as you considered the various arguments, would come to the same conclusion. But I might point out that never during that debate did I hear you consider actually lowering the tax rate or the various elements, key parameters in that bill in an effort to stimulate even more investment.
Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I think in your opening comment you said that, I want to quote it exactly as I can, if prices continue, then you would stand to lose $1.8 billion. So the question is, if prices continue, which I guess is whatever, 62, whatever it is today, how much would your company actually profit from the state of Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, I definitely don't have that number. You're correct that my statement referred to $18 billion over 10 years, not money that we would lose, but money that we would pay in taxes. There is no dispute that we would also, we as a company, would make significant profits during that time, but at the same time, the state would also receive significant revenues in terms of royalties, state income taxes, property taxes, etc.
If I can continue.
Yes.
And I think you know we already know that. What I'm suggesting is that there must be some level of oil prices where you feel that it's unbalanced, because that's the term you used. And that's the term we used in discussing the PPP, is that it was unbalanced. Mm-hmm. In fact, substantially unbalanced. It just reminded me of a teeter-totter that was shoved all the way at one end, and now what we're trying to do is rebalance the teeter-totter. But of course the person who had the advantage is going to say, you know, the initial proposal was tolerable, but it didn't really lead to a balance. And so that's the work we're doing here, is to try to find the balance that says ConocoPhillips is not going to run away and say, you know, you guys have treated us poorly or unfairly. Although I have to say, with my colleagues' comments here, I saw the television ads myself, and I said, I'm going to tell you what I thought. I said, that's dirty. And you can take that to the bank, because I think a lot of people said that's dirty. You were, or your company's ads, not you, but your company's ads, I think, tried to convince the public that ConocoPhillips was in trouble, the state was raising taxes, and in essence, it might be a good time to pull out or to reduce the all the investments you're making. I wish I had the money to write a TV ad that said, you know, here's the other side of the issue, but I don't. And I'm not going to try to raise it either. But I think you should be on notice that that sort of thing doesn't help the people that are trying to work on this when it's fairly one-sided. And you had an opportunity to say, we understand that the state has a certain interest. And our interest is, you won't believe it, but it's fairness. It truly is. And that's why I asked the question. At current prices, a reduction of $1.8 billion in ConocoPhillips profits represents what? Is it truly unfair? Because if we turned around and wrote you a check for $1.8 billion on top of what you're going to make at the current prices, wouldn't you think that is the most unfair thing we could do?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, on several counts there, I think we disagree. Let me see if I can recall them and take them in order. With respect to the unbalanced nature, your concern that the PPT bill as proposed represented an unbalanced tax regime for production tax, we definitely disagree. We look at that profit tax, the structuring with a cash flow, net cash flow element, as essentially a very progressive tax that as the company does better, as the industry does better, the state also will receive more in tax revenues. It does provide that balanced effect all the way up the curve. It is not simply a flat dollar amount by any means. So in our view, that proposal did in fact provide a fair balance at all prices for the state of Alaska in terms of production tax. Now, the other statement you made seemed to imply that we as a company, since we have invested lots of money here, we're not going to run away as you raise taxes. You're probably right. We can't run away. We have too much invested in large assets here in Alaska. Our point to you in our testimony before and our testimony today is those large assets take money. They take money to continue to maintain and run. If we lose confidence in our ability to make big long-term investments here in Alaska and don't continue to maintain those assets, we will see our production decline. The state will see production decline. The state will see declines in state revenues and ultimately long-term in jobs. This is part of our concern. I don't dispute that our company will make money at higher prices, no doubt. That's why we're here. But I also think that the state of Alaska receive a lot of money in state revenues, tax revenues, by having the industry here.
Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Since we started all this, I've asked questions about what you as oil companies have based your projections for what you think, you know, in your best guess, what long-term prices might be. I've never gotten any answer other than, you know, well, your guess is about as good as mine. We hope they'll be in a range of $20 to $40 a barrel, and think maybe they might go over that, but we don't know. And I've never gotten a anything close to a firm answer as to what projections. Yet, in the beginning of your testimony, you said that, you know, we're going to lose $1 billion to $1.8 billion, and I mean you threw out some pretty firm numbers there. How much you were going to lose by paying taxes to the state of Alaska? I'd like to know exactly just what you're basing that on, because if oil prices are at $22 a barrel or something under $32 a barrel, according to Econ One, this tax bill makes you money. I mean, you pay less taxes to the state of Alaska at $32 a barrel under this bill than you do under the old ELF. I think that there's still well, there's plenty to be unhappy about in this bill on every side. I really worry about the state of Alaska at the low end, or lower end. Although $32 a barrel would have made us all real, I mean, like overjoyed just 2-3 years ago. Mm-hmm. So if you could respond to that, I'd appreciate it.
Through the chair, Representative Crawford, I think as we indicated before, we definitely do not make our long-term price forecast public. But I think we have had several economists present varying views, and I don't think any of those economists are telling you that today's prices will continue indefinitely and rise from here. I would agree with that. The billion-dollar number we use was patterned after the number that was released by the administration as they put out their proposal. And again, I think every time we've talked about it, we've tried to be very consistent that if at today's prices, those are the type of numbers in terms of tax revenues that would be payable. But your prior statement is correct, that your guess is as good as ours in terms of whether it will actually stay at that level for that number of years. In fact, I would put money on the fact it will not. So I think we as an industry share your concern that prices will not stay at this level. But that said, again, we tried to pattern that number after the administration's figure. The other statement that I think you made, Representative Crawford, was that the PPT at low oil prices actually makes money for the industry. And it's not exactly true. I'm not sure that's what you meant. It actually results in us perhaps paying less than we would under the current severance-based system, the ELF system. But it doesn't actually make money for us. My understanding,
that was a fallible mind.
My understanding of what the premise behind this bill was that the administration and the state was willing to accept that downside in exchange for more upside, for having a more progressive system. And yes, in the low oil price scenario, this type of a system, a net cash flow type system, is beneficial to the companies, to the industry, in the sense that the tax revenues do ramp down as prices ramp down, as our profitability ramps down.
Representative Ledoux.
This is a follow-up on Representative Kapsner's and Representative Dotto's lines of thought. You mentioned that you didn't create these ads yesterday when the CS points came out. I was just sort of curious when you did contract for the ads.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I guess I don't know the exact date. It's only been within the last week or more that we put those together. They are, again, from our perspective, as we saw some of the questions and heard some of the testimony before this committee and the Senate Resources Committee, our concern was that too much of a one-sided one side of the story was being presented and through the television, and we felt it was part of our obligation to help show the other side of the story. We definitely have another view, a different view, than I think the one that is largely being presented before these committees.
Thank you.
Representative Olson.
It's my understanding that you're in the process of going back into Libya. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Olson, that's correct.
And about 20 years ago, all the American companies were thrown out and everything was nationalized?
Through the chair, Representative Olson, yes.
What's the government take in Libya?
Through the chair, Representative Olson, I'm not clear on that exact number. You may know off the top of your head.
I think it's around 90%. Does that sound about right?
It is. Through the chair, Representative Olson, it is very high. There's no doubt about that. If I may continue?
Oh, certainly.
The difference in my mind between what's going on in Libya and what's going on here is a question of prospectivity in terms of the known resources and the likelihood of finding large resources to be developed. It's very different in Alaska than it is in Libya. My statement before was we are going back into Libya, though not through, as I understand it, through lease bid rounds, but more through coming to an agreement with the Libyan government about stepping back into the assets we previously had there. So it's very different from simply buying into the ongoing new leases.
Well, I guess the question that needs to be asked is, since their taxes are 15, 20 points higher than ours, are you going to be running ads on TV in Libya?
Through the chair, Representative Olson. No, I don't believe we'll be running ads on Libyan television.
Take the record to show I did not ask that question.
Representative Kapsner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That was good. I did get a copy of Representative Guerra and Senator French's letter, and I'm reading it trying to, you know, I think your impression was that it suggests that private profits are bad. I think that's what you stated in your testimony. And I just don't, when I read it, that's not what I'm gleaning from this. the things that stand out to me are sentences like, we believe the ads are misleading at a time when it's very important to educate Alaskans fairly about the issues of oil tax reform and whether they're receiving a fair share. It says that that ConocoPhillips implies that your company is paying too much, when in fact the after-tax profits your company earns in Alaska are staggeringly high. And it has 4 points that illustrate this profit. And I just felt, looking at the letter, that I don't read any implication that that's a bad thing. I think that all of us, especially me, are acutely aware of the contribution that your industry makes to Alaska. 80% of what we bring in comes from your industry. And we definitely appreciate that. And I think that those of us who are looking at this new tax are very concerned about what it's going to do to our economy and also how we're going to pay the bills in the future that we haven't been able to pay in the last 10 years. We've been, on the decline in terms of keeping up with inflation for education. Corrections are going, we're nervous about how we're going to pay the bills. But I don't think any of us feel that your profits are bad or that you make a profit is bad. It's just what is fair. So I just I wanted to address that issue of the perception that your industry feels that some of us in the legislature may feel that private profits are not a good thing.
Comment or no?
Through the chair, Representative Kapsner. Correct. Obviously, you and I have a different reading of that letter. I think our reading of that letter is that there is a implied complaint about profitability in Alaska, and to us, that doesn't ring true.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
Follow up. What I'm focusing on is that the ads are misleading because it implies that. Our taxes are too high, or that looking at changing the tax would somehow cripple your industry. When you look at the profit earned in Alaska was $829 million on $22 billion in gross revenue. So, I just want to let you know that I, for one, am not out to get you or want to take all your profits or want to scare you away. I feel the ads are a disservice to the Alaskan public who maybe don't get a chance to look at your bottom line.
Through the chair, Representative Kapsner. Our bottom line is definitely a public document for everyone to see. We do not believe the ads are misleading.
If we can get a copy of your testimony, and for what it's worth, I may be the only person in this building that believes this, but the ads didn't bother me. I saw it. I got it emailed to me by, I believe, Mr. Rick Meyer with the Daily News, and maybe I'm grown cynical. I don't know.
That's for Jay.
So. With that, if there's no more questions, we sincerely appreciate you coming forward, and I'd like to remind you as well as everybody else, and all of you people who are going to testify already know this, this is the beginning of a very long process, and I realize that you already know that, but we appreciate you taking the time to come forward. And for what it's worth, I appreciate the civility that particularly my co-chairman and I have been shown by every person in industry, in the administration, and in the legislature has shown the two of us. Because I haven't had my arm twisted. I've been having anybody, there's been political pressure. People can say, I put it on myself, I think, but I've had none from anybody in this room or on the third floor or on the fourth floor or anywhere else, and I sincerely appreciate that. With that, if we can get some copies of that testimony for distribution, we'd appreciate it.
Great. Chairman, committee, thank you.
Next, we're going to change the agenda a little bit. Mr. Foley with Pioneer has an appointment that he can't reschedule, so... with my apologies to Mr. Hanley and Mr. Walker and Williams and the two gentlemen online, we're going to move Mr. Foley up the agenda. And with that, Mr. Foley.
Thank you. Representative Samuels, Representative Ramirez, and other members of the committee, thank you. For the record, my name is Pat Foley. I work with Pioneer Natural Resources, and I'm the manager of lands and external affairs. thank you for having an opportunity to speak with you today. As many of you know, Pioneer is a relatively new investor here in the state, and we certainly appreciate the opportunity to participate in this process. I think one of the wise members of this committee made a statement early on in the hearings, and I'll paraphrase. The statement went something like this, and it was that when considering changes to the tax, the legislature can either choose to shoot a little high or choose to shoot a little low. And at that time, they were choosing to shoot a little low and to leave a vibrant industry. And at Pioneer, I'm afraid that the committee substitute proposes now, you're going to miss that mark to shoot a little bit low. I have 5 points that I'm going to make, and I'm going to make them as succinctly and briefly as I can. First, when we look at the proposed tax structure and we look at the reduction in the value of the exemption, we believe that the committee substitute will not create the investment-friendly climate that I believe was intended by the original administration's proposal. Second, the progressive tax rate and the way it's structured, I believe it fails to take into account that at higher oil prices, an investor's costs increase dramatically. At Pioneer, our personal experience last year, 2005, in the lower 48 drilling development wells, we experienced cost increases of 50%. And in 2006, we expect drilling costs to increase again. I think it's a misconception that as oil price rises, the profit margin increases, you know, in direct relationship. In fact, that profit margin decreases because the costs do increase. It may not be a linear relationship, but there is absolutely a connection. Third, the committee substitute appears to have a provision that would extend the Senate Bill 185 expiration incentive credits for an additional 10 years. And while that's helpful, it's helpful in somewhat of a modest way. The expiration incentive credits have a provision where you can take up to a 40% credit on certain activities, but because only certain of the costs are eligible, it translates to an effective credit that's much closer to 30%. And at Pioneer, we believe that a more efficient, a more effective, a more beneficial way to incent the industry would be through a PPT credit. Simply take the 20% number and push it up. That would be more beneficial, and have it apply not just to exploration, but also to development. The fourth point, the bill has a proposal that $10 million of credits could be purchased at the state at face value. And while that's helpful, that's beneficial, again, it's beneficial to an explorer, but not necessarily to a developer. When you look at Pioneer's investments at Agouric, we'll spend for the next 2 years roughly $100 million, and then it'll fall to closer to $50 million for the drilling phase for the next couple of years. We hope that that's combined with a robust exploration program. Our total investments in the state would generate, we believe, credits far in excess of the $10 million. And again, while it's helpful to be able to sell those at face value, we're left with to whom do we sell our remaining credits.
What do you mean in far in excess? When you talk about the amount of credits that somebody like Pioneer at an Ugric or another development like that, I mean, because there were concerns that we had with an open-ended state has to just on the hook to buy. So what range of numbers is somebody like you moving forward, what range of numbers would you want the 100% buyback for the state? Without, obviously, our concern was open it up to hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars.
Very good, sir. Representative Samuels. At Agouric, we believe investments this year will be something on the order of $125 million, something in that ballpark, north of 100. And when we combine that with an exploration program, let's say the number's close to 150. And at Pioneer, we have no production. So we'd be looking at not just a 20% investment credit, but we would also be looking to sell our loss, for lack of a better description. So a 40%, 40% of $150 million is 50 plus million.
20, 60 million.
60, okay.
Representative Seaton.
Just trying to make sure on your testimony, you think that this is a good provision that we've put into the CS over the sellable credit that was in the original bill. You would just like it to be at a higher number. Is that correct?
Yes, Representative Seaton, through the chair, that's exactly correct. As an alternative, some other suggestions we'd made in the past is the state could establish sort of a discount floor. They'd buy it at X percent, and if you could sell it to some third party higher, then so be it. That would be helpful. The other element that would be helpful to a company like Pioneer would be if we could expand the pool into which we could sell that credit. Specifically, if the credit could be taken not only against PPT tax, but also against income tax, then it would broaden the pool outside of the industry.
And just to let you know, the thinking in the CS, the thinking, because that was one of, I believe, that AOGA, the entire industry had come together with that, and the thinking on not having with the income taxes was that at low prices, we're already taking risk from the progressivity, but at the low end, we're getting less. We didn't want to put the state on the hook also for the income tax money. We wanted to have some steady cash flow at the low end for the state also, so it was a protection of the state not to include it against the income tax. Just so you know how the discussions went. Representative Seaton.
And we were talking earlier, thank you, Mr. Chairman, about 90%. Does that number, I mean, and of course I think testimony was, gee, if it's 100% it's great, if it's 95 it's you know, really super. Is 90% a floor that you could live with and that would be helpful?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, yes, 90% would be a helpful number to use.
Okay, thank you.
And have you sold credits in other areas? What, generally speaking, if there's not a cap, if Exxon and BP and Conoco didn't have a cap, I assume that they compete against each other, and it just goes up. It's free money to them. So I would think it would be above 90% as long as they're out of not under the cap. You'd sell for 98 or whoever wanted to.
So. Yes.
Okay.
That's exactly correct. And then my final point is, if in fact the bill must have a progressive tax rate, and if the trigger point for that tax rate is an oil price, there's two points I'd make on that. First, we encourage that whatever prices are used, that they be inflation adjusted. And secondly, that the benchmark price not be WTI, but be perhaps ANS West Coast delivered price, consistent with the other section of the bill, which is 43, 55, 160, G, and H, which is the transitional capital $40 floor.
Okay. Representative Rammers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Foley, thanks for your testimony. Always very constructive in the way that you frame things to help us craft a better bill. One of the questions that I have for you that Mr. Hanley, I think, is also going to bring up in his presentation, so I'd like to get some insight from you, and then I'll try to ask one of the producers as well. I am sensitive to an inflationary component to this, because I recognize that the cost of exploring and the cost of developing is going to go up. This is what Mr. Hanley and I were discussing prior to this hearing. The question I have for you is, what about the price of oil? Is it subject to inflation, or is it driven more by global demand, speculators, and global events? I certainly understand that the costs incurred in discovering it and bringing it to market are subject to the same inflationary pressures that everything else in the world is. But the question I have for you specifically is if you can try and separate those two pieces for us. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Certainly, Representative Rammers. I think you're correct. There may not be a direct link in inflation or any of the, you know, inflation adjustment factors and the price of oil. However, I think oil prices, just through time value of money, you know, $50 today is worth far more than $50 5 years from now. And whether the inflation rate that you would use, there are many choices. Perhaps it's more of a discount rate that would be more appropriate than a PPI or an index like that. But the point is that if the legislation is today based on a benchmark price of X, then X should have the same buying power throughout the whole term of the program.
Yes.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. Again, I ask you because I like the way that you address these things. I think you're just the best presenters that we've had. Isn't that addressed in the PPT portion? And really the issue that you're talking about with regard to inflation is only the component that starts to move to the ANS and the West Texas Intermediate piece. The PPT, the inflation, takes care of that because it is a profits production tax. So the only part of your question, just for the benefit of the members and for myself so I understand what part of the problem you're framing is just the windfall tax as we go over our PPT piece and we go into the $50 component and the progressivity. That's what you're narrowing your constructive criticism to, is just that piece. Is that correct?
Yes, I believe that's correct. I think about that.
You have other criticisms, yeah. We realize.
but again, the progressive nature fundamentally is that at higher prices, the state should enjoy a larger piece of the pie.
Yes.
And my point is that make sure those are real price changes and not just through inflation.
Just a quick follow-up. So, Mr. Foley, what you're saying is that the PPT part of it works and that your criticism is really the progressivity piece. That's the inflation-adjusted or the piece that is not inflation-adjusted. So your criticism isn't the governor's part of the bill. It's just the augmentation that the House Resources Committee put on through the progressivity, which is trying to share during times of high oil prices. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I hope you don't get all upset at me. But I've tried.
I've been beat down, buddy. I'm not upset at anybody.
Tried not to editorialize too much and get off the subject, but, you know, I find this something I just can't let go. But it just seems to me that if we're worried about inflation proofing oil taxes, it seems like we should also think the same way about minimum wage and unemployment insurance and the percentage of the well, I mean, poverty rate, all of those things should be taken into consideration as well, but we don't. Just had to put that in. Thank you.
I'll comment on that. I don't know if you're going to want to or not.
Prefer not to. Thank you.
As long as this piece of legislation is not in a contract, you would always have the ability to petition your government to come and adjust things like the minimum wage. And which is, I've always been opposed to having inflation indexers in there. It tore me up to put a price of a barrel of oil in a piece of legislation because it seems like 5 years from now is going to be an arbitrary number. Maybe it's high, maybe it's low. Maybe costs have decreased and technology has taken over, and we should have had it lower. Maybe your profits go up as technology increases. Maybe your costs catch up, and we should have had it way higher at the trigger point. But inflation indexing puts in there and assumes something which I don't believe is true. So legislatively, I would think if there's a problem, the industry is not going to be shy about changing something. If you start putting it in long term, then is where we start to have more issues along those lines. So with that, I don't know if I agreed or disagreed with Representative Crawford. But anyway, Mr. Foley, if you have any other points on that, and do you have copies of that testimony? Or
I have handwritten notes. I'd be happy to reduce them to more formal writing and submit them.
If you could,
case.
That would be great.
Very
that
good.
Would be great. We very much appreciate your time.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Okay. Next up is Mark Hanley with Anadarko. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Mark Hanley. I'm the Public Affairs Manager for Anadarko Petroleum. I'm also a recovering politician, so I understand some of
our angst.
what you guys are going through. I just a little off topic again, but I would just say we faced a different scenario when I was here with many hundreds of millions of dollars of fiscal gap on the low end, so it was a different scenario at those times. But I do understand what you're going through and the kind of issues that you're facing, and I will be brief, and I will try and point out just in general terms so you as policymakers can make the decision what we think the general impacts of this CS will be. And I'll just point out to remind people, our original testimony just very briefly was that 2020, as introduced by the governor, we felt was a balance. And the balance was we would pay a little more in taxes because we're both a producer and an explorer, but that we got some downside protection. And it also improved our exploration economics. So that on balance, we as a company felt good about the proposal as it existed. Just to get right to the point, on balance, I think this goes a little bit the opposite direction. So we would feel that the exploration economics have been decreased. Our costs have gone up a little bit. So on balance, this proposal is not as good as the 2020 as it existed. And for many of the same reasons that were pointed out by Mr. Foley before me, I would just say, you know, we understand what you're doing and the changes that you're making, but I just want to let you know what we see the impacts are. And to the extent you want exploration, we think this is a little worse for exploration than the current bill, the proposed CS as it's being proposed. So as he pointed out, the 40% credits that are going to be extended under the existing EIC are a benefit, but they are not a significant benefit or not enough to offset some of the other changes that were made in the bill. And as was pointed out, effectively they are less than a 40% credit. And I would point out that under the EIC, they apply to one well. In other words, the first exploration well, whereas the credits throughout the PPT formula apply to your exploration well, your delineation wells, your development costs as well. So they have a much greater impact the way the credits under the PPT are structured. And again, while that expiration credit was helpful, did not offset some of the other changes that we saw. And I would generally agree with
Hanley. In particular, the offsets, I'm assuming that you can leave on this particular point, leave the progressivity aside for a second. The reduction of the $73 million in essence to $50 million is not offset enough by the SB 185 extension. Is that basically the trade-off that you're talking about?
Yes, I guess so. And that's the simple. As we pointed out, I think and as other people pointed out, the smaller companies get more affected by a reduction of any type in that particular allowance than others. So that simply put is it.
Okay, thank you.
But I will get to the progressivity and a couple of issues that were raised. I would just say the same thing, that the costs, I mean, there's an assumption that because the price goes higher that we can afford to pay more. But that does not take into consideration what the costs are doing. And as you pointed out, Mr. Chairman, I would say they could be going down. But generally speaking, I mean, we do discounted rates. You saw a net present value analysis. The whole point of that is to say, hey, here's the time value of money. It's worth less in the future than it is today. If there's an assumption just because the price goes up, let's look at, and I would agree maybe with your consultants who have said, look, if there's something happens in the Middle East and today the price goes to $100 a barrel, can you argue that your costs went up? Not today, probably. I mean, that probably is a significant. But if you're looking at, we're looking at over a 10-year period, and the cost, for whatever reason, goes up to $60 or $70 a barrel and stays there, I think it's pretty likely that our costs are going to go up and be higher. So without some cost factor in there, particularly on that section, as you pointed out, Chairman Ramirez, that is this escalator, because under the original PPT, it's kind of all works itself out. You get a deduction. Under the escalator, it is really a tax on the gross revenues that does not have a consideration for cost within it. So that's where the concern gets to be. And what's the best way to address that? I know people have concerns with inflation adjusters, but I would point out that earlier in the bill, there was an inflation adjuster for, you know, to the state's benefit on the $40, you know, because they didn't want people taking those carry forwards, as you call them, if the price got too low, but they're going to inflate that price of the $40, yet they're not going to inflate the price of the base of $50 when they could actually have an impact. The other thing on the escalator that I would like to raise is, let's go back to the example, something happens in the Middle East, the price of oil for 6 months or a year goes up to $100 a barrel, and the tax rate goes up to, I don't remember what it would be at 100, but say 35% or, you know, whatever it is. For those of us that might be looking for gas, you have now increased the tax on gas based on an oil price change when the price of gas may still be at $6 an MCF. And that is very dangerous because there is not a relationship. There may not be a cash increase on the gas side that would help us pay that cost. And I would say the risk of that can have a real dampening effect on gas expiration, because if we have to be considerate of, you know, we run our numbers and then all of a sudden oil prices go up, we get a higher tax, but we don't have cash to cover it. That's a real problem. So somehow applying a tax rate increase based on an oil price to gas does not make sense to us.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. I had a couple questions, but on the last one, separating gas from oil for progressivity, I understand that. Do you have a schedule of progressivity that you would like to see for gas on gas prices, and it would make sense to you? I mean, you know, we can guess in the dark here, and we've focused on oil, and you know, we may see the same thing in gas. We don't know, but do you have anything like that that you can share with us?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, I don't right now, but we can work on that as we move forward. If that's someplace you would like to go, then I think we can provide comments on that. But I don't have anything right now.
Okay, I appreciate that. Yeah. And my next question was, you know, the cost increase that we've been talking about, seems like most industries have been worrying about energy costs, you know, because that's a huge factor in the equation. In the oil industry, you're getting to use all that free, aren't you? I mean, either gas or under this bill, oil that's used for operations and power, anything you're using within your operations, that's going to be free, isn't it? So that's not an escalator?
Mr. Chairman, through Representative Seaton, no, it's not free to us. For instance, we do not, I mean, we have to buy it from somewhere. Our contractors that run the drilling rigs charge us for whatever is paid on a rate. And I would also say that to the extent that it's, you know, it's driving up steel prices because of the cost to generate steel, the pipes that we cost go up. I mean, obviously we get more revenue on this side, but it does have a cost impact to us. I
guess just to follow up, operations in field, whether you're using gas for compressor stations, whether you're using gas for drilling rigs, whether you're using gas for, and I think in this bill we've also extended that to oil, so that for oil or gas liquids that are used within the lease area for operation of the lease are going to, I don't even think you pay royalties on those, do you?
Through the chair, Representative, see, I understand what you're asking now. I was looking at an expiration program suggesting that we have to pay people, you know, for the Rologons to go out and the fuel costs. And I understand you're asking me for an infield cost where we're using fuel from the existing field. So I would say to some extent we do have that fuel available to us there. That is correct. But other costs do continue to go up. But I think you're
Yeah, okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Ramirez.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mark, I did appreciate earlier having a member of the oil company try to explain your increasing cost by suggesting that energy was one of the costs that was driving your costs. I appreciated the irony in that part of your presentation earlier. I've been thinking about it all through lunch and enjoyed it immensely. The question I have for you is really surrounding the volatility of natural gas itself. You have, in sharing your insights with us through this process, which I appreciate, brought to our attention that gas and oil do move separately. And so the concern that I have, to follow on Representative Seaton, is with natural gas, which seems to have its own volatility, how do you recommend, and can you get back to the committee, please, with your thoughts, as to how we would come up with some progressivity for gas that's separate than oil? Because after Hurricane Katrina, of course, we saw the opposite of what you talk about, which was relatively stable oil prices. Although there was some oil shock, the cost of natural gas tripled or quadrupled and has now fallen in 60% in the last 60 or 90 days. And so we need a mechanism to address the same kind of a progressivity in gas. But I agree with you. I think that they ought to be separate, whether they're addressed by this resource committee or whether it's just a memorandum that this committee forwards to the Finance Committee, and they can work on a range of progressivity now that we've introduced it as a key component of the resource version of 488. If you have some thoughts that you can get back to us on that or to the Finance Committee as this bill moves to them, I think would be helpful. Any thoughts about that?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, I don't think it's – I mean, the numbers – picking the numbers are more the issue than the concept, because eventually when you have gas being produced, there will be – a Henry Hub price, and you start working your way back for transportation costs to get to a wellhead to multiply times your production per day. I mean, that's how you're going to get a gas volume. So that idea is not, I don't think it's been contemplated per se in here. When the tax rate was the same for both and not affected by price, it didn't have a huge impact. But there will have to be some place, whether it's, you know, here it's West Texas Intermediate, do you use West Coast, or how you do that. At some point, you're going to have a similar process for gas when there's gas production that goes on that will, I'm talking about North Slope now going down through a pipeline. You'll start it somewhere, you'll back out the transportation costs, and you'll get to a wellhead value. At that point, whatever that cost is and whatever that range, I think the concept's similar to what you've looked at. The real challenge is picking what's the appropriate number and progressivity, if that's what you want to do. So I don't think the concept is hard to come up with per se. It's more coming up with the numbers and what's the right number.
Okay. And then also, if I could, Mr. Chairman, the inflation piece. And again, this was our conversation, and I was just asking Mr. Foley about this. How do you think fair means for the state to address the fact that CapEx and OpEx have an inflation component, but it's addressed in the PPT? And so it's really only the progressivity piece that is subject to some degree to inflationary pressure. But, I mean, just using natural gas as an example, it has followed no inflationary curve over the last 270 days since Hurricane Katrina. It's followed, you know, speculators and world events. But the cost of sourcing additional gas, not in Alaska, but around the world, certainly has followed prevailing inflationary trends. How do you think that we can maintain our progressivity and address the inflationary component on the windfall portion on the progressivity side of it?
Through the chair, I might need to get back to you. I mean, I obviously you can use an inflation factor. You can actually put it below the line. That allows you to deduct your expenses. So you make instead of just taking it on your gross, have your progressivity apply below the line. That has some ability. I'll have to think through that. I hesitate to throw things out because I need to get other people that know more than I do about the proper way to address that. But we'll get back to you, Mr. Chairman, with some thoughts on that. But, again, the main point is just looking at the price side, and they may not all go up at the same side, and I don't disagree, but there can be cost factors that are not being considered as part of that, and that can have a negative impact if your costs go way up, but the assumption is, again, that your tax rate goes up because the price goes up, but without a consideration for cost, that may not be a fair, as a policy, you may not even agree that you should take that much if the costs have truly gone up through no fault of anyone else's. So.
Representative Seaton.
Mark, can you explain that a little bit more to me? Because we have a profits-based tax, so it's going to be on profit. So all of the costs get allocated out and are all subtracted out. Doesn't matter what those costs do, they all get subtracted. So they're all taken into account. And so we're talking about tax on profits. And yes, there's some incrementals on based on the price, but it's the tax is all going to be on profit. So I'm trying to figure out where the incrementalness needs to come, since if there's increased costs, they get all deducted before we ever get to applying the tax anyway.
Through the chair, I would say that is not quite correct, at least from my understanding, the way this is going to be drafted. The 20% tax will be on profit. The incremental taxes will be on income, gross income. That's my understanding of how
it is deductible off of the PPT. So the $50 mark could be in the wrong place as your costs increase. You could get to the point where you're not making as much money at 50. You could inflation-proof the 50 to go up higher. Your costs could decrease with technology, in which case the $50 line could move over.
But I just want to make sure, and maybe I can ask a question as well. My understanding is the way this would work, let's look at a $60 a barrel price under the way the CS is working. My understanding is up to 50. You know, you have the 20%, so you get a $10 a barrel increase. You have a 0.3%
escalator.
So $10 times 0.3 gives you a 3% additional tax, right? The way I think it's going to be drafted is that you will take 3% times your gross revenue before you deduct anything. You'll get a tax. That'll set over here. Then you go through, deduct all your expenses and costs, come up with net income. Multiply that by 20% will give you a tax. You add the two taxes together, and that's your gross tax against which you can apply credits. And that's where I think, if I'm understanding it correctly, that's where the problem with that 3% does not have a cost factor in it. It's just multiplied times your gross revenue.
And we haven't seen the CS, so we'll
draft conceptually.
Yeah. Is that
is the problem?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, okay. Oh. I didn't know if you were through or not.
I'm through.
No. There's no more questions. Thank you very much, Mr. Hanlon.
Thank you.
Next, we've got Angus Walker and Tom Williams from BP. And, Mark, do you have copies of your comments or some bullet points or anything for the committee also, or were you just... Top of your head, okay.
Chairman, would you have handouts? We also have one in the bank. We have a file on the table.
Okay.
We will refer to those as we go through our testimony.
You want to give us just a second to distribute those? And
I'm going to go to Eddie's if I'm not sure we give it enough.
Sure, you want a second? We'll take a brief Eddie's. We are back in order, and with us now we have Angus Walker with BP and Tom Williams, Tax Counsel with BP. And welcome back to Juneau, gentlemen.
Thank you. For the record, I am Angus Walker, Commercial Vice President for BP in Alaska, and alongside me today is Tom Williams, Tax Counsel for BP Alaska. And I would like to start by just thanking the committee again for the opportunity to testify on what is obviously a very important issue for us. And I've also made the commitment to the chairman not to repeat our previous testimony, albeit that we obviously stand by it. What I would like to do is build on a few of the key issues that were raised in that testimony. And the first is about production forecasting and decline. And I'm going to start with a slide which was actually presented by Michael Williams in the last week when he presented the Department of Revenue forecast on oil production, showing that each year, showing the forecast that had been made for each year back to 1999. And while there's a lot of information on that first slide, it does highlight the challenge of accurately forecasting production. Since 1999, both industry and the Department of Revenue have consistently overestimated production and have annually revised production forecasts down significantly. This is of great concern to us, and we believe it should be of great concern to everybody in Alaska. A 100,000 barrel per day drop in production represents a drop in state revenue of $500 million. We believe production decline is the key enemy and the common enemy. The following chart, which is built on one that we did use in our testimony, this is the second chart in the pack, shows the historic production from the Alaska North Slope. It shows the Department of Revenue forecasts for the year from fall 01, fall 03, fall 05, and now spring 06. And we see the precipitous decline in those forecasts. The spring 06 forecast is now sitting on the future projection of 3% decline. And if I may take us to the third graphic in our pack, you will hopefully recognize this from our previous testimony of 2 weeks ago, where we try to outline the current reality of the Alaska North Slope. And we talked about a scenario with zero investment, where the fields would decline at 15% per year, and the business would be over by about 2015. We talked about a future where production would decline at 6% per year, with an investment, ongoing investment of $1 to $1.5 billion, and that's the investment that's currently being made in the North Slope. Where the business would be over somewhere in the 2020-2030 timeframe. And then we talked about a 3% decline scenario, which would require investment to be twice that which is being made today. So an investment of $2 to $3 billion a year in the Alaska North Slope, which would extend the business out to 2050 and keep the oil business healthy for a timeframe which could support gas. And the real question we believe that you should be asking industry and asking ourselves as industry and the consultants that have come before you is, what would it take to double investment in the Alaska North Slope?
Representative Rammers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Here's the real question I'd like to ask you, Angus. I'm taking some offense to the way that the testimony is shaping itself today. Certainly not from you, and not the manner in which it's being presented, but the content that is being put before us. Because what I continue to hear now is that what makes Alaska worthwhile to invest in is not the reasonable profits that are gleaned by the industry as we move through the 2020 PPT that has to happen at reasonable oil prices, not at stressed oil prices. I sat through, Mr. Chairman, I didn't sit through as many tedious meetings as you, but I sat through perhaps 15 multi-hour, multi-day meetings this spring, summer, fall, and winter on the gas line, and we kept talking about stress price of gas. And now we have really, over the last 3 or 4 weeks, started talking about the stress price of oil. $20, $22.50 was represented to us as the stress price of oil for BP, at which it becomes break-even or less than break-even, and I accept that. I'm not here to quarrel with that figure, you know, although I respect some of the other members for calling that figure into question. But we certainly determined that $30 and $40 are reasonable, that we may see those again, that that $50, all the economists told us that $50 certainly represents the high side of any planning that an oil company could do. And so I'm finding myself here over the last hour and a half here, good-naturedly, but beginning to take some offense at the suggestion that when we start to see high oil prices, that is what justifies industry being here, is not the profit that they enjoy at reasonable oil prices, but it's the opportunity to capitalize on the enormous profits that come when oil is in this upper quadrant, where if we accept this as extremely high or record high rates now. And so your testimony, it says here in bold, underlined, the real question for you to be asking industry and the consultants is, what would it take to double investment in the Alaska North Slope? And before you pose that question for us, I'd like to pose the question to you that the real question for us to be asking the industry is, at what point on a progressive scale does the industry want to share the windfalls with the state of Alaska in some progressive mechanism? What's your point? We went all the way out to 50 in our CS. We covered the whole range of economic models that every presenter in front of us made. At what point do you want to share?
Chairman Ramirez, I think as we go through our testimony, you'll find that we are not in favor of a progressive regime. We do not believe it is the right regime for Alaska. Alaska is a very tough place to do business. We make no money at low prices. We make moderate profits at medium moderate prices. When the prices are high, we make good profits, but we have to make good profits to be in business.
Okay.
Mr. Williams, comment, though? Can't resist.
Since you invited me, you know, a lawyer can't stop himself. I have a question about what people think is profit and windfall profit today. In March 1980, and I'm sorry, this is going to be more stuff off the top of my head. But in March 1980, Sohio, who was our predecessor on this one, and actually an affiliate, had a long-term West Coast price of $33. They raised their price in March of that year, and it stayed at $33 until December of that year. So it's not a flash in the pan price. That's $75 today in buying power. Where's the windfall start? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
I would also just like to close out on Chairman Ramirez's question. It did bother me when you took us say you're taking offense at testimony and you realize it wasn't our testimony. I'd just like to clarify what we're here to do today is present the reality of the business. We are seriously concerned. Okay. We're seriously concerned about what's coming out of this committee. We were seriously concerned about the PPT bill when it came forward. All we can do is be honest with you, share with you our views, and let you make the judgments on behalf of the people of Alaska.
Thank you.
I have a quick question.
Reverend Kapsner.
One of the things that I've heard, and you can correct me if this is wrong, is that at $18 a barrel, Alaska is still looked at as, industry is still investing when it's $18 a barrel. Is that right?
Through the chair, Representative Kapsner. We as an industry, because of the nature of investments, tend to invest through the low cycle as well as the high cycle. What I can say about our business in Alaska is we stopped making a profit at $22.50. That's the reality of BP's business in Alaska today. Now, if the price of oil went to $20 tomorrow, we would continue to invest in those projects which were ongoing, those projects that had long leads, in the belief that the oil prices go down, oil prices go up. But if the oil price was low for a long time in Alaska, it is a very, very poor place to do business. This is one of the most expensive provinces in the world to produce oil and gas. And therefore, the profits have to be made at medium and high prices.
Representative Gatto.
Thanks. Would it be true, though, at $20 a barrel and you'd be losing money? My guess is as a good investment, you would probably reduce some of your exploration. But at that low price, wouldn't you be losing money worldwide? or would you say it's just more expensive here and you lose money here at a different barrel rate than you would in some other place?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, Alaska is one of the most expensive places to produce oil and gas in the world. Therefore, the point at which we make zero profit will come earlier in Alaska than other places around the world.
And if I could just follow up.
Yes.
An average place, if it's $22.50 in Alaska, typically across the spectrum of all the places you are, is it, do you have a number?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, that's a great question, but I don't have the answer to that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If I bring us back to the bottom of page 3 in our testimony, encouraging new exploration is good, but in fact, a fact that has been acknowledged by all who have testified, that the resources expected to be discovered through exploration will likely be significantly less than the resources we already know about. It is investment in these known resources that offers the greatest chance of stemming the decline of the Alaska North Slope. As you look at incentives for exploration, you must not overlook incentives for investments which are more likely to succeed. Moving on to page 4. Clearly, the tax regime that you design will directly impact how attractive Alaska is for investment, and that will translate into what the future decline rate will be. It is in the interest of all, industry and Alaska, that we focus on growing the pie rather than increasing state take from a declining pie. The following slide is an attempt to show how growing the pie by incentivizing investment is in the best interest of the state over the long term. And you'll recognize the scenarios which we presented to you before: 15% decline, 6% decline, 3% decline. In each case, obviously, there's a certain amount of oil produced, with 15% decline, 1.3 billion barrels, 6% decline, 3.6 billion barrels, 3% decline, 7.5 billion barrels. And the capital investment required to make that happen is significant. For the 6% decline, $20 billion. For the 3% decline, $60 billion. Huge capital investments required on the North Slope. And then when we take those scenarios and calculate the state revenue that goes with them, you'll see, which is not surprising, that in the 3% decline case, there is a significantly higher revenue to the state. And the key point here is that the revenue to the state is significantly higher, regardless of how much severance tax you collect. The revenue for the state is driven by royalty and the other elements of taxation in Alaska. And therefore, it would be a great shame if we ended up in the left-hand side of this page with lower volumes, lower capital investment, and lower state revenue because we instituted a severance tax which was too high, which did not encourage investment. The highest state revenue is derived from the scenario which delivers the greatest production, regardless of what severance tax PPT you collect. You could collect zero severance tax, and this would be a better outcome for the state than one where you collect a high severance tax and have less resource development. The size of the pie is the most important consideration. Maximizing the value of resources for Alaskans means maximizing state revenue by maximizing production. Resources left in the ground are simply a wasted opportunity.
Representative Gatto.
I hate to admit this, but I'm having trouble understanding it. Back to that page. At 6%, well, let's go to 15%, which is the decline rate. You invest $1 billion and you get 10. Is that 10? That's the 10 to the state, but I'm guessing that means it's 30 to the company. Is that correct? I'm looking at the pie chart's proportions.
through the chair, Representative Gatto, all we have represented here is the revenue to the state.
Okay. But if the pie chart is proportional, then if there is $10 billion to the state, then I'm going to guess that's only a quarter of the pie. That leaves three quarters or $30 billion. And you go to the next 6% decline, it says there's $30 billion to the state, but it took you $20 billion. And so $20 billion was invested to increase the state revenue by $20 billion. Means to me that you're doing, or the company we're doing, that green area substantially better. But that's an incredibly larger investment. It almost looks like the more you invest, the poorer the return for you. Although the state seems to do okay because we're not doing the investing. And that's the confusing part to me. I want to be sure that I understand that getting $60 billion more in state revenue requires a $60 billion investment on your companies, and that must mean that you have to look at the $60 billion investment and saying, what are we getting, I mean reasonably, what are we getting for our $60 billion investment? So is your company going up, and I'm going to have to assume the pie charts are proportional, correctly proportional. Do you know if that's true? Because we don't have a number on the pie chart.
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, probably proportional to the numbers which are stated beneath them.
Okay. So the yellow then is the state's.
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, I'm sorry. We tried to simplify this, and I obviously didn't do a very good job of explaining it. So maybe I could just run through it one more time, and hopefully that would, okay. With your questions in mind, hopefully that would clear up any confusion. In each case, we are taking the business as it exists today. And maybe I could draw your attention to the previous slide, because the two are linked. In each case, there is a business that's existing today with all the historic capital that's been invested and production that's already developed. If we don't invest anything, then that production will flow, provided we continue to make the expenditures and operating costs, etc. And in the second case, the 6% decline case, we're saying we have to make an investment of between $1-1.5 billion a year in new wells, facilities, etc., to make that happen. Mm-hmm. And in the third case, we have to make an investment of $2-3 billion a year to make that happen. So that's the three scenarios. And if we move over to the next one, what we have done here is we have said the total capital that would need to be invested, and by invested by industry, not just by BP, that's the third line that's captured as a total over a period of time, probably over a period of a number of decades. And then from that derives the production, which is listed in the table, and from that derives the revenue. And the revenue is coming to the state in all the different forms of taxation that you have, property tax, mm-hmm. etc. And PPT, the whole pie is state revenue. This isn't showing anything about what we get. So the point we're really trying to make here is that what really matters to Alaska and Alaskans is barrels down the pipeline. Because from its extra barrels down the pipeline that you get royalty, property tax, state income tax, etc. And what may be happening at the moment is that gilding the lily, pushing severance tax too far, if that pushes the wrong way in investment, we believe that's the wrong answer for Alaska.
So I guess the conclusion is that the state is much better off at the slow decline, which I think everybody would agree with, but it takes a significant company investment to make that happen, and you need a certain amount of money, or it doesn't make sense to all your investors and stockholders. So, and I guess the ultimate question that we're all facing here is, does this interfere with the 3% decline scenario? And you're saying, yes, it does. And the question then we have for ourselves is it a better deal? for, and I guess we're worried a lot about ourselves, as you should be about yourselves. Is it a better deal? And I wish there was a page that simply said, best deal, you know, like you go buy something, you know. Six pack is a better deal than a single can times six. And that's what we're, that is essentially the difficulty that we're having. I love these charts. I love the colors. I love the proportions. I love the numbers. But is it helping me to make that decision of, you know, maybe we ought to go for 6% decline. Maybe the 6% decline is in our best interest, although the 3% decline certainly helps my children and their children more than it would help me. But I'm looking out for them much more than I'm looking out for me, and I'm concerned about that long decline as well, and just trying to arrive at that. And I wish, if you ever show us something in here that answers that, boy, just wave or something, because I'm looking for it the whole time.
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, can I just correct one thing? At the moment, we are on a trajectory of 6% decline, and have been for the last 10, 15 years. The real issue is that we will stay on that trajectory unless we attract more investment to Alaska.
That's helpful.
Yeah. So if by pushing PPT too high you move us further than 6% decline, then that's a bigger loss to the state. The real opportunity, as we would summarize it, is for us to get us onto a better trajectory, a 3% decline, one that will keep the oil industry healthy for the very long term, and enable gas. Because at the end of the day, we can't have a gas project without a healthy oil business.
And then I guess it's the last question on this thing. Are you thinking that the 6% trajectory is the ideal place for the company? Or if there were no change in the tax structure, you'd be heading for the 3% trajectory? But the tax structure change could keep you at 6 and actually bring you closer to 15.
Representative Gatto, the 6% decline is where we are and where we have been with the existing tax system. We have been very clear in our conversations and testimony that the new tax system is a huge burden, an additional burden on us, the major producers of the North Slope, and therefore we are concerned that it may move us off the 6. And the real point I'm trying to make is that we collectively, between the industry and the state, should be looking for what's the solution that gets us onto 3% decline? What's the solution that attracts the extra billions of dollars per year to Alaska that really delivers the right answer for Alaska? And that solution could be stimulated by lower taxes, not higher taxes.
Okay. And just a comment, that is exactly what we're trying to do.
Therefore, we are concerned that the conversation is continually about more rather than about how about lowering taxes to really stimulate activity.
Understood.
Yep. Ramis, Seaton, and then Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Angus, I see that I'm going to struggle with the same issue today. I'm looking at the same pie charts that Representative Gatto is. I'm less impressed with the pies and the colors than I am with the very small print at the bottom that says, assuming $40 ANS. And I guess my frustration a little bit is born out of the fact that in helping to craft this CS, we were so cautious. It is perhaps the aspect of the CS that I'm the most proud of, is that we called a safe harbor the whole range of prices at which the industry said this is where we do our economic planning to determine whether a project is commercial. And we're well outside of a $40 ANS. And so I am struggling with the notion that we didn't even implement any kind of an augmented tax structure. We left the PPT as described by the governor intact through that whole suite of prices. And I'm telling you, I think the industry is making a mistake to stand its ground on this point, because I think that you will lose a lot of the goodwill in this building, and I mean that quite sincerely. I'm happy, and I'm struggling
with the press, with people back at home, with my members on this committee and in this building, that 50 is giving away the farm not to trigger a progressive scale at 40 or at 45. And like Jerry Maguire, you had me at 50, but I keep seeing these I keep seeing these references to assuming $40 ANS, and then I say, well, at what point do you want to share the wealth, the windfall? And what I'm hearing back is that, yeah, we do all of our planning at $40 ANS, but unless we get all the profits out there at 50, 55, 60, 65, and 70, it's not worth it to us. It's not economic in between at 30, 35, 40, 45. And I'm struggling with the posture that you're taking, because you're losing my goodwill. What do you think?
Chairman Remmers, please don't read any into the fact we use $40 ANS. We use that as an illustration. We could produce this chart for you at 50, 60, 70. It would say exactly the same thing. The only thing that matters for the people of Alaska is getting volume down that pipeline. That is the only thing that matters, because that is in the best interest of the industry. It's in the best interest of the people. And I'm sorry for being a broken record, and I'm sorry that you don't like our point of view, but our point of view hasn't changed. Our point of view is that higher taxes will not encourage investment, and we believe that lower taxes are the way to encourage investment.
Mr. Chairman, it's not the way that the people out there feel, because they've been communicating with me. I don't know about the other members in this committee, but that's not the message that the public is giving to me. And so I'm new at being a legislator, but I'm trying to steward a course that balances those two needs. And if you ask me what's more important, to get the more oil in the pipe, or is this a tax bill, I'll tell you it's more important to have oil in a pipe, and that the tax component is a strong second. But I'm definitely an oil in the pipe guy. But I'm telling you, there's got to be some point at which industry says, we're happy to share above a certain price point. And the fact of the matter is, yes, you could have drawn this with 50 or 60 or 70, but you drew it with 40. And every time that industry came in here, they talked about this price range, 22.50, 30, 35, 40, well up into the 40s. And the chairman and I and every member here that we consulted as we drafted this CS, we came to a consensus of trying to respect that range of prices and to provide safe harbor to the industry for all their economic planning. And that's the part that is troubling me today, is to hear industry come back and say, well, 50 is not good enough. There should be no progressivity. And it's just that's the part that's bumming me out.
Chairman Ramos, I think we have to remember where the 2020 was born and where that puts us relative to the status quo. And I think industry, I speak for BP here,
yes, sir,
was very clear at the time that we did the deal with the governor, which we were taken right to the edge of our rope on, that we were willing to share the upside, share more of the upside than under the current system. And that's what the 2020 does. So I don't want us to forget where we've come from and where we've got to.
Yep, Representative Seaton, Crawford, Olson, and Kapsner.
Thank you. I'm looking at this 6% and 15 with zero investment. We've got a broken elf. Everybody knows that. You know, it's gone down even before, when your investments were being made before the aggregation of Prudhoe. We've got, guess what? We don't have $2 to $3 billion in investment when you were getting all of the tax break.
Yeah.
The broken elf was giving you all the tax break, and you weren't doing those investments. You weren't doing that. So I have a hard time you coming in and telling me that if we lower taxes back towards elf, it's going to stimulate your investment. Because everything we've heard from you, everything you've demonstrated by your investment not being there for the 3% decline, but being at the 6% decline, said that you'll take your money and invest it someplace else. Unless we tie it to an investment credit or some other way to make you to twist your arm to put the investment in Alaska. So I'm having a real hard time figuring out where oh, well, if we have lower taxes, we'll invest. When that's not been the demonstration. You're very pie chart here. $1 billion is the average over there before aggregation. When this was, you know, when ELF was just down at the bottom and all the taxes were going in your pocket, you weren't doing the investment to get it at 3% decline. And so I guess I need some comfort, and you need to tell me how this is going to work unless we restructure this tax to twist your arm to give you an incentive to make those investments by the tax and the tax credit.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, there's a number of things in there, and I'll try and address them all as I go through. I guess the first one is I would counter that we have been investing in our business. We invest about $700 million a year in capital, and we've done that year in, year out. The second one is we can't see what the exact relationship is, and I think this is where we sympathize with the committee and everybody in this building that's thinking about this. What's the relationship between investment and taxes? What we can say is that at the moment, the industry, and this isn't just about BP, this is about the industry in totality. The industry in totality is investing between $1 billion and $1.5 billion a year at the current tax structure. And the laws of economics will say that by increasing taxes, it makes Alaska less competitive. Therefore, you're going to have to struggle even harder to get that investment and more. The third thing I would say is we absolutely agree. The capital credit structure is a good one. We've always said that the PPT structure has merit. The numbers just need to be right. So having the credit structure in there to incentivize reinvestment in Alaska, I think we're all agreed that works, and we believe it would work in the future. But the numbers for the whole PPT structure have to be right.
Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've heard quite a bit of testimony on total government take, and I remember Mr. Johnston said that if you take worldwide averages of total government take, Alaska looks pretty good. He said that once we discount for the quality of crude, transportation costs, the cost of production, all of those things are taken into account, that we should get it down to about 65% and we'd be at the worldwide average. But the projections that we've seen on some of these charts here is that this mean not the CS, because we haven't seen the CS yet, but the 2020 bill that we had gets us up between 57% and 59% of total government take, which would mean that we would be leaving billions on the table over the long term, as compared to getting us to a worldwide average of total government take. So we've been on a 6% decline rate, even when we were leaving large amounts of money on the table under this scenario. Shouldn't we look at some other area? What we hear from some of the explorers around here, that a barrier to entry and a barrier to exploration is the cost of facilities access and cost of the pipeline tariff and other issues are keeping them from doing the exploring they'd like to do on the North Slope. Couldn't we get more investment that way rather than keeping our taxes low, which hasn't seemed to work in the past? Our taxes seem to be much lower than the worldwide average, even after you've discounted for all the conditions that go into them. Thank you.
Through the chair, I apologize if I didn't follow all the questions that were in there. I'm not sure how many were questions and how many were statements. But with respect, I would like to try and answer, address some of them. Government take, you've talked about it a lot, 61% is what the 2020 gives you. That's 61%. That's the marginal government take. That's what it trends to as prices get high. The government take, still under the PPT system, and if I remember my numbers right, is 114% at $20. At $30, it's still about 70%. So I have to take issue with the fact that the statement that Alaska's government take is low. Alaska's government take, when you consider in real terms across the price spectrum, is very high. And then you consider it to the U.S., and Canada, and it's the highest and will be the highest by a long way compared to the U.S. and Canada. So the notion that Alaska has a low government take, we absolutely don't agree with. And we actually think that you are further differentiating yourselves from your competitors by raising it still further.
Yes, follow up.
So... Are you taking out royalty owners in the rest of the U.S. As a part of that? I mean, because here the royalty owner is the state. In Texas, I'm the royalty owner. Tiny little piece of it, but I mean that has to be considered as well. I would imagine.
Through the chair, if I may go to my, I'm just going to go to the next part of our testimony is to talk about U.S. government take, and there will address the other states, and in calculating government take, we've built in royalty, severance tax, all the taxes that are paid in the same way as we have done in Alaska.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Olson.
Well, I hate to bring up government take again, but I think we're on a roll. The last couple of weeks, everybody I've met in the oil industry is either going to Libya or coming back from Libya. So I'm assuming that BP is either on the way or over there or getting ready to go. Would that be safe to assume?
Through the chair, Representative Olson. I have to say you've kept me so busy on this that I've kept taking my eye off the ball as to what's happening in the rest of the world, so I couldn't possibly comment.
No, are you in Libya right now or going back into it? Or
I'm embarrassed to say I don't know what we're doing there.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe you can help me walk me through something. At 75 to 80 bucks a barrel, our total take is less than 65%. Libya's is at least 90. They're a third world country with a better climate than ours, but political instability, they have a history of nationalization. Everybody's going over there to pay a 90% take. How can you make more money at 90% than you can at 65? I know you have to sell a lot more, but am I missing something?
I need to preface, through the chair, I need to preface my comment by saying that I don't know, I haven't looked at Libya, I don't know what's going on at Libya. But maybe I could just respond on the basis of there are some regimes who can afford a very high tax rate. And I'll use Norway as an example. Norway has had a very high marginal tax rate for a very long time. But Norway's got a wonderful resource base, and production has been growing in Norway for 30 years. So I would say that they can afford to have a high marginal tax rate because people can still make money and it's still attractive for them because of the quality of the resource base and because of some of the other things they do with the tax structure.
But when you're comparing, follow-up?
Yes.
When you're comparing us to fields in the rest of the country, at least in the U.S., nobody has the potential that we do they? We're missing possibly the Gulf of Mexico, offshore, deep.
Yeah, there's clearly huge potential in the Gulf of Mexico. I think the point is that no one has the cost structure that you have either. Alaska's resources are challenged, and the fiscal structure needs to enable investment and attract investment, recognizing the nature of the resources. And it's the nature of the resources, the viscous oil, the fact that we're looking at the enhanced oil recovery of the existing fields, the distance of gas to market, as well as location. You know, an Arctic environment with an 800-mile pipeline and a 2,500-mile marine voyage. It all adds to reduce Alaska's competitiveness.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Just moving on to talk about the United States and the marginal tax rates in the rest of the U.S. The good news for Alaska is that there is a huge known resource. The bad news, it's technically difficult. Alaska already is one of the most expensive places in the world to produce oil and gas. And assuming the new 2020 PPT is put in place, Alaska would also become the area with the highest marginal tax rate in the United States. Needless to say, this introduces one more barrier to attracting investment. And the incorporation of yet higher tax rates at higher prices is yet another take from industry and creates a bizarre fiscal regime, being regressive at low prices and progressive at high prices, thus reducing space for industry and creating yet more barriers to attract investment. To maximize the value of the resources in the ground, the legislator should be focused on maximizing North Slope production by attracting investment. The priority for the state of Alaska should be to encourage investment, to help industry develop those known resources, not to make it more difficult and risky than it already is. And in respect to Representative Crawford's question, the illustration here shows the total take, and we have included private royalty owners in there as well. So we believe it's on a like-for-like basis across the United States. And I would like to move on to talk about the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom as a role model for attracting investment. And I'm going to choose a quote from your own consultant, Daniel Johnston. Ordinary measures of government take throughout the 1990s made the United Kingdom government appear rather crazy and irresponsible. The gross benefits to the UK government go way beyond direct tax revenues and royalties received from the upstream sector of the petroleum industry. The economic impact of the industrial hyperactivity in the UK sector of the North Sea was a direct result of the lenient terms of the 1990s, and it's difficult to measure. Furthermore, the activity in the UK started in the late 80s and early 90s when the UK government dropped the ring fence for the 75% PRT before government take, as it is ordinarily measured, was drastically reduced. The UK offshore became the most active offshore province in the world. Reducing the government take in the following years managed to sustain that boom. Activity and employment in the British petroleum sector is healthy and robust. You have heard much over the recent weeks about the impacts of reducing taxes in the UK. The UKCS has been our backyard for many years, and we couldn't agree more with Daniel Johnston that reducing taxes firstly created and subsequently sustained an economic boom. The UK's decision to reduce government take led to a significant increase in activity in the North Sea, more production, higher revenues for the government, and a ripple effect throughout the whole economy. The actions of the UK during the 1980s and 1990s provide an excellent role model for any government hoping to attract investment. Let us please not forget the urgent need to stem decline and attract significantly more capital, about twice that which we are spending today, to the North Slope. In order to maximize the value of Alaska's resources, we believe you should be adopting tax rates lower than those proposed by the governor. In so doing, you would maximize investment, maximize production, maximize jobs for Alaskans. You would also take an important step towards creating a healthy oil business, which will be the foundation for gas. We recognize the burden on your shoulders in making these decisions. There are many people advising you to increase taxes, which will indeed increase state revenue. But for how long? For 1 year? 2 years? And at what cost to future production? The substantive changes you are considering making to House Bill 488 are yet more takes from industry, over and above the government's bill, and we cannot support them. Our key objections to the proposed changes are: the proposed progressive tax rate system is inappropriate given Alaska's circumstances, the challenged resource base, the high-cost environment, the distance to market, and the regressive nature of the rest of the fiscal regime, and the urgent need to attract very large amounts of capital to stem decline. Almost every proposed change in this CS amounts to an increase in take from the industry from the previous proposal. These changes represent a significant increase in tax across the board and will not help attract the additional investment required to stem decline of the ANS. The change in the effective date means this tax will be implemented before it is enacted by the legislature. The transition provisions included for good reason in the governor's bill have been significantly reduced, making the implementation unfair on historic investors. I'll leave, ask Tom if he'd address the last two items.
The penalty and interest. This is on the 90% monthly payment. Let me explain to you why those are inappropriate. The federal government has a rule where you have a, you don't get penalties and you don't pay interest if you settle up on April 15 as a personal taxpayer. And you, if you make, if you have withholding taken from you, you're fine. If you're self-employed, you have seasonal employment or something like that, you're supposed to make estimated taxes during the course of the year. And the reason the government gives you a relief from penalties and doesn't charge interest is because, especially for people who are self-employed, they're a seasonal occupation, fisherman, farmer, they have commissions and they have a big influx of commissions at Christmas time or the holiday season from their sales, whatever it might be, they can't predict in March when they make their first estimated payment or April, and then again in June or July, you know, what their total is going to look like for the year. So they make a good faith estimate and they go forward. And that's the principle behind the federal system. It's exactly the same situation here. In for January production in a year, we will have to file at the end of February. We'll know what the gross value was, the market value and the netback price for that January production, but we won't know what the year's total of capital costs is. We won't know what the year's total of operating costs are. We will know what the budget is. We can make an estimate about what those will be. But often what happens is capital costs tend to load up at the end of the year as people try to get things in service this year so for federal purposes they can take tax depreciation that year. But what happens if somebody is late delivering the stuff that you need? There's a storm and the barge can't leave with a new module that's going to come onto the slope and it's $100 million. You can suddenly find yourself there in November having expected to have a 20% credit for the capital expenditure that was going to be put in and arrive in December, and now it's not going to happen until January. You're over optimistic in what your credit would be for the year for all of those first 11 months, and now you're going to pay a penalty and pay an interest on it. The original, there were discussions about what this says with the administration before the governor introduced the bill. And the original discussion was recognized that, that people will do the best they can to estimate what these costs will be and go through the year. And the counter to that was, yes, but what if somebody decided they were going to only pay $1 each month and then write a huge check at the end of March, which is the true update for the year? We don't want them to be playing games like that. So that's where the 90% came from. It's to keep people honest. They had to do a reasonable job of estimating what their year's liability is going to be so that the state would have regular cash flow. But it still wasn't the idea to say you've got to be accurate in forecasting the full year's worth of costs. You've got to be accurate in forecasting the full year's worth of credits that you're going to have. And in that sense, you're exactly like a person who has a fishing season in the fall or who has a harvest in October, or has a commission and sales at Thanksgiving and Christmas. They can't know in January, February, March, those first months, what their year is going to look like. And that's where this came from, was to keep people honest in terms of making payments to the state, but they can't know the right answer at the time they're making those payments. They can only do the best they can, and that's why it's inappropriate.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Rammers.
Thank you, Tom. I couldn't agree with you more. And I'm a small business person. There's some other small business people at this table. We're all subject to quarterly taxes. I do everything I can to manipulate the system with the federal government. There are many quarters where I have overpaid for precisely that concern because I didn't know what, couldn't forecast out what my obligations were. And I just suggest to you that, that you're right. and so is this committee. And you know, I object to the way the federal government does it also, and they approach it with great vigor, and it's been the will of this committee through consensus with its members to approach it very vigorously, this provision. And I think it really stems from the people that I've spoken to be honest with you, is how much the oil companies over the last 20 years have manipulated the accounting and how much ill will they have created in requiring the state to pursue litigation in order to get its fair share. I've been doing talk radio, and that's what I hear back. And so if you wonder what this is born out of, I couldn't agree with you more. But there's not this breath of goodwill on the table amongst the public. And that's who members of this committee have to react to while we're producing good public policy. So, and these are just the seeds of summers past that have, you know, come back to roost.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
If I may, just to kind of set the record straight on that, despite the large tax settlements that there have been and the large royalty settlements and the huge litigation that we've had in the past, the fact of the matter is that when you take out the interest that was involved in those claims, the oil companies paid more than 95% of the tax and royalty liability they owed at the time it was due. These settlements, although they're billions of dollars, are less than 5% of the principal. So I understand that there's a public perception out there. That perception is part of the reality that you all live with and that you have to deal with. And all I can say is the public are mistaken.
You have the luxury of saying that.
So do you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
The discussion that I had just actually this morning on this exact issue, Mr. Williams, was that, quite frankly, that BP, Conoco, and Exxon never had this problem. BP, Conoco, and Exxon know exactly how much you're going to pay. And I realized, does changing the system for you because of the cost allocation issue do it? Because the way it was explained to me just this morning was that the three big companies, you've got the entire department of which you are the king of one of the departments, you know exactly how much you're going to pay, and you pay it whether or not you have to walk it over there and hand a check or whatever. The big three are always not the problem on this, and it is some of the much, 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 much smaller players in Alaska that don't have personnel here at all that tend to be some of the problem. So do you think that, if you've never really had a problem with this in the past, do you think that because of the new system and the cost allocation system, you have trouble month to month where we didn't have that problem under ELF? Or do you see this as more of a philosophical opposition?
No, Mr. Chairman, I think that, first of all, it's enormously flattering to think that it's easy for us to do all this and not have a problem. But let me tell you how, we have two people who manage our volume accounting, keep track of how many barrels and how many cubic feet of gas come out of the ground, where they go, whether they're taxable or not. And then we have a couple of other people who make sure the data are entered properly in the computer. And there's me, and there's my boss, Bernard. And that's it. We're the team. I mean,
you got a big compliment from the state that I was talking to this morning. That the state says, well, that you and Exxon and Conoco simply
it's a wonderful
are right on.
It's a wonderful tribute to the team, but the point is that we have a system that we have been able to perfect over the years. We have the Department of Revenue has allowed some taxes to be filed by electronic means, and obviously if you have computers doing the arithmetic and you've tested the algorithm so that they're doing the arithmetic correctly, they're always going to add the numbers to the right sum. So we can do those types of things, but to change, that's the problem, is redesigning so that we can comply with this. That's a, our abilities there have been greatly overrepresented.
Okay, thank you.
I guess I will come to closure fairly quickly. I would just note that obviously at the time of writing, at the time of this presentation, we haven't yet seen the CS, so there's other things that we're going to be looking for in that CS, and particularly how some of the issues raised by ILGA will be dealt with.
Okay.
I'll close just by summarizing our key points. Production is declining. This is the real issue that's facing us all. To maximize state revenue, the industry must increase investment and reduce that decline. By what's being proposed, Alaska will have the highest tax rate and the highest cost structure in the United States. The proposed amendments to House Bill 488 will not maximize the benefits to Alaskans from the state's revenue resources, oil or gas. And we would draw your attention to the UK as a great role model of a place where reducing taxes has increased investment, production and revenue. And while we won't go through it, we did leave with you a letter to the chairman of both the House and Senate Resource Committees addressing some of the issues of the UK tax system and how the UK has addressed this issue in the past. We believe the proposed amendments to House Bill 488, if enacted, would be a serious mistake for Alaska, and we urge you not to adopt them. In any event, we will continue to participate fully in the legislative process and will be urging the legislature not to enact the substantive changes being considered, but to enact instead a bill close in structure to the original bill, but with tax levels lower than the 20% first proposed.
Okay. Thank you very much. Representative Seaton and then Representative Kapser.
Two questions. First of all, we talked about the UK and the drop. Are you suggesting that we should look at the UK as they treated the legacy fields and kept the high oil tax on legacy fields and dropped it for exploratory fields? Is that what you're projecting?
I think we're saying you need to come to a conclusion that fits for Alaska, fits for what you're trying to achieve, and fits for the resource base that you have. We think the UK was a marvelous example of where they reduce taxes on across the board, not just new fields, but also legacy fields, and that stimulated investment.
Okay. And for Mr. Williams, I guess I didn't quite understand. You were talking about capitalization costs and not being able to tell when they'd come if the barge was late and arrived in January. Are your capital, do you not incur your capital costs when you, let's say you build a new module or something and ship it and it, you don't capitalize that until the barge hits Prudhoe Bay? I mean, you don't make those expenditures ahead of time?
No, we pay our bills as they come in. But if you start off in January and you're expecting something to be finished by the end of the year, and let's say it's being built in the Gulf of Mexico, and there's a strike or a hurricane or some other event beyond people's control and delays it, we're not going to be paying. I mean, I think that we don't know as well to get to 90% accuracy. And I mean, if this were a two-way street, that if we overpay, well, we would get interest, and if we underpay, you would get interest, and if we severely underpaid, you'd get penalties as well. You know, that's a playing field perhaps that's more even, because you can make your best shot, and if you're too high one month and too low the next month, over time, if you're reasonably good at your forecast, it's all going to be a push. But the system that's set up in the governor's bill and is not proposed to be changed here is interest owing to a taxpayer doesn't start until 90 days after the due date when you file and show that you've got a refund coming, that you've overpaid. So, I mean, it's the severance taxes work in the past, you know, where there's overages and underages, they just sort of cancel each other out, and it's not been a big deal.
And follow-up. Yes. Are you saying that your capitalization costs, you're going to want to write those against your January of the year before tax instead of paying the severance tax and writing those capitalization costs later in the year? I mean, it seems to me like you don't have that problem unless you're trying to forward capitalize and forward credit and take them off against your first taxes.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, what I'm trying to say is no. Our billings that we pay, the costs that we pay, and as an operator that we bill to the partners, are basically, you know, costs as they're being incurred. We're writing checks. And so we can keep track of the checks. The problem is, in March, we only know how many checks we've written through the end of February. We don't know how many checks we're going to write in April, May, June, or July. If we don't write the checks that we expect to write those months, we'll find that we over-deducted or over-credited ourselves in those first months of production. when we filed our returns. And it's too late then, because the way this is written, if we didn't hit the 90% mark, each of those months, we'll have a penalty and interest.
Okay. Thank you both very, very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Next up online, we have John Zager, the Alaska General Manager of Chevron UNICAL. Before Mr. Zager goes, I'd like to ask a question. Mr. Owen, are you a thumbs up to testify today? Okay. I've got two online, and then I've got you. So with that, if we could welcome Mr. Zager.
Thank you, Chairman Samuels, Co-Chairman Ramirez, and members of the committee. For record, my name is John Zager. I'm the General Manager of Chevron in Alaska. I have today with me again Kevin Tabler, who's our Land and Government Affairs Manager. And I provided testimony previously to this committee on March 1st. My intention here today is just to comment on the four-page summary of the changes that are coming from the CS.
Thank you.
I'll just point out we've only had a few hours to react to this, and I've learned quite a bit on the call today, so we'll see as we go through this. When I spoke to you earlier, in a general manner, there were kind of three points I hope you took away from that. First being that the Cook Inlet is different than the North Slope and should be considered for special treatment under the PPT. Another, I urge you to consider all the levers that were in this bill and not to pull them all in the same direction at the same time. And the third was to keep things as simple as possible so as to avoid adding unnecessary costs both to the industry side and to the state side in tracking this. In general, we find that none of this counsel was retained in the, at least in the summary of the CS that we've seen. Now I'll go through and just make a few comments on each of the substantive changes as they were laid out in the CS. The first being the rate, the progressive tax rate. First, I'd like to applaud that we've held the line on the 20% base tax rate. I'm sure there was a lot of discussion on moving that up, and we urge that it shouldn't go any higher, as did many of our fellow industry players, and so we applaud that move. The way I understand that the progressive tax is laid out now, it seems very complex in the context of almost an incremental change for very small movements in the price of oil and whether it's going to be tracked on a daily basis. I would urge you to consider a much larger step function if that's the way you go, so that maybe every $5 increment you see a substantial change. If you average $5 for a month, for instance, and maybe there's a process laid out in the complete CS how this is done, but on first blush it seemed quite complex and could take a large effort to track. Another question, and some of this has been covered by other people in previous calls, in previous testimony, in fact, probably almost all of it is. I know Mr. Hanley, I believe, talked about why it is pegged to WTI. ANS may be a better marker. And then also the discussion about gas and why the profits for gas business would be tied to an oil marker. I think that's especially true in the Cook Inlet, where we're not even going to be connected to the North American grid and have our own unique gas contract situations. And then we've also had discussions about the price step, and it's not inflated, the $50 starting point. And I would note, as has been noted previously, that the $40 indexing price is inflated, so it would just seem a fair and equitable to if you're going to have a pricing mechanism on the $40 for the transitional money, that same mechanism could be applied to at least the $50 starting price on the progressive rate. And then there's been a lot of discussion, too, about windfalls, and I just like to say that, you know, taking the windfalls away, no matter how you couch it, lowers the expected value to investors. I think everyone recognizes that, and, you know, there's a debate about maybe what the fair rate would be, but I think if you look at any business, it could be a fishing business, and if we define maybe the 60 best days of the year as windfall profits days, and then we told the fishing company that on those days we're going to take up to half of your profits, I think anyone who owned that company would say that is going to affect your view of the business, and it's certainly going to affect your view of whether you want to buy another fishing boat and go out and start a second operation. So you know, the windfalls, we think it's kind of free money up there at the top, but it is part of the overall distribution of expected results when you're looking at making your investment decisions. So in general, this is a move against industry, and it's a move against additional investment in the business in Alaska. The next one I'd like to move on, just talk about the transitional money. This has been talked about also. I quickly modeled the effect on Chevron's annual deduction and taking away the first 2 years and then putting the percentages on the last three takes our annual deduction down by a little more than 80%. So that's a very substantial hit to that. It's just what it is. It's an increase in taxes. As I mentioned earlier, the $40 indexing price is inflated. And this is another move that pulls a lever against industry. And I think it penalizes the companies that have been faithfully investing, even during the down years 4 or 5 years ago. And now we're being taxed on those profits that are benefiting both the state and the companies. The expiration enhancement, and this is one of the ones I've been learning a lot about as I've gone by, listened today. And so I don't want to spend a lot of time on this. I just want to emphasize here that I think that the choice between 185 and the 20% rate is not a big value addition, and that the credits on the backside of this for any investment decision is very important. To be honest, Mr. Chairman, I think I may have somewhat misinterpreted the third bullet, and so I would rather not spend a lot of time talking about the rest of the slide with your permission.
Okay.
The next slide is no credit for abandonment. I don't know if this has been discussed earlier, but inclusion of the abandonment as an expense would certainly promote timely abandonment of operations. And I think just from a fairness standpoint, the state has benefited from these assets for many years, and it is a legitimate cost of production. So this is another lever being pulled against industry. Then we've just got the additional comments, private royalties. I really don't have a particular comment on that. That bullet was in the summary. AOGA technical changes. Again, I don't want to get into details there, but let's just make sure we get it right, because we'll all be involved in resolving this at some point in the future if we don't. The contingency surcharge is a small dollar amount, amounting to pennies per barrel, but over the industry it adds up during the year and is another move to take a little more money from industry. And the effective date was just discussed. Just, again, fairly arbitrary move to take a little more money against industry and from the investors. The next bullet was issues surrounding the $73 million allowance. Reducing it to $10 million is essentially changing the $73 to $50 million has been mentioned before. Again, that's more important to some players than to us, but it is a substantial part of the overall package as we saw it. Tax credit repurchase program, that helps a few players, especially the smallest players, but it doesn't do anything for Chevron. And then the penalties for underpayment of less than 90% of the monthly tax liability, I think that was just discussed in great detail. We would share the view that the 5% is punitive, especially when it's layered on top of an 11% base rate, which already, I believe, has a punitive component. And this has been an issue we've actually been concerned with for a couple of years, because often these discrepancies are only found on audit, which may be a couple years after the payment was made, and you've been being retroactively charged 11% for what is just an accounting issue that certainly was not any malice intended.
Mr. Zager?
Yes,
I got a question. I had a question on the tax credit repurchase program. You wouldn't anticipate Chevron selling tax credits?
Well, Mr. Chairman, my anticipation is that we'd have sufficient cash flow of our own that we wouldn't need to sell those credits.
Okay, thank you.
And then my final point here, and one that probably hasn't been made by anyone else, our biggest disappointment of all was that the Cook Inlet was not at all recognized as being distinct and separate from the North Slope in terms of its profitability and its unique and value position to the state of Alaska. We think there's a lot of good reasons why additional investment should be encouraged in the inlet, both to help promote local economies from oil production and to help supply gas to fuel the power needs and heating needs of the area. The revisions that put forward in the economics will lower investment opportunities in the Cook Inlet and the returns on our projects, and the four-year capital program that I discussed previously will be, I think, will be put in serious jeopardy under this bill. Without capital investment at MacArthur River Field, which you may recall is the biggest field, it's the anchor field in the Cook Inlet, it could be gone in 4 years, give or take, depending largely on oil prices. And once that critical mass is gone from the Cook Inlet, which helps support the service industries in the area, I would predict that the Cook Inlet oil industry will kind of shrivel and die in the vine in not too distant future. And then also industry will probably be in the position of certainly produce out the remaining proven gas reserves in some of these large fields, but without additional exploration, I don't think that business looks exciting in the long term either. So trying to transition to my my final slide, if you were keeping score, and
shut out.
As we went through there, it looks like all these levers we're talking about kind of got pulled eight in the state's direction and zero in the industry or in the investor's direction. So, and I will grant you, each and every one of those levers probably could have been pulled harder than they were. So I do see some restraint and some measured thought, and I appreciate that. But again, each and every lever was all moved in the same direction. So you need to look at the cumulative effect of those. And in this case, I think what it's done is change this from a bill that we, along with most of our peers in the industry, could reluctantly support to one that we view as lopsided in favor of the state and is therefore one that we cannot support. We talked earlier about trying to make the pie bigger, and that's been discussed a lot today. We think, you know, that's the way to go. Getting a larger percentage of a smaller pie is not as desirable as encouraging investment and getting a fair slice of an even bigger pie. So I appreciate the opportunity to share a few thoughts with you today, and we'll certainly remain engaged in the process as we move forward and appreciate all your hard work in putting this forward.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Zager. And just as you well know, it's the very start of a very still-to-go long process. I would think that Cook Inlet will be...
Yes, sir.
Are there any other questions for Mr. Zager? Okay. Thank you very much for your time today, sir.
You're welcome.
Next is online. We have John Hansforth, the manager of International and Frontier Operations with Talisman Energy out of Calgary, Alberta. Are you with us, Mr. Hansforth?
Yeah, Chairman Samuels and Ramirez, committee members, good afternoon. My name is actually Tim England. I'm the Senior Manager for Global New Ventures of Talisman Energy, Inc., which is the group in Talisman that searches for exploration opportunities internationally. A few years ago, I led our entry into Alaska for Talisman. With me today, I've got Rod Wade, who's the General Manager of International Operations, and John Hanforth, our International Operations Commercial Analyst. This afternoon, I'd like to provide you with a brief description of Talisman, our current activity in Alaska, which is being operated through our FEX LP subsidiary, and the potential impact of changing the Alaska fiscal regime on our future investments in Alaska. Just a little background, Talisman is a Canadian independent with production and exploration activity around the world. We have an enterprise value nowhere near the size of some of the earlier speakers this afternoon, but a healthy $23 billion. And we have capital investments on the order of $3 to $4 billion per year. We're currently producing and are exploring in North America, in the North Sea, in Southeast Asia, and a list of others, Australia, Trinidad, Peru, Colombia, Qatar, Algeria, Tunisia, Gabon, and Romania. We're a new player in Alaska in 2003. Since we entered, we've invested over $30 million in land and over $100 million in drilling and seismic acquisition. The wells we're drilling in Alaska are costing on the order of $30 to $35 million each. It probably only costs you about $6 million to drill in Libya. Due to the remoteness of our exploration activity and other factors, a commercial discovery here would take 5 to 10 years to put on production. You know, that is a long time from initial investment to begin to recoup the investment. The front end investment in exploration is risky and, of course, comes with no guarantees of a return. Our decision to enter Alaska was based on the current fiscal regime continuing for the duration of our activity there. Now, we have to accept the risk associated with commodity price volatility, as well as the risk of rising and changing costs. But fiscal stability is really important if we're to successfully manage these risks. The proposed fiscal changes will have several predictable impacts from the perspective of explorers in Alaska, such as Talisman. First, exploration opportunities which were economic under the previous fiscal regime will no longer meet our economic hurdles for investment, even taking the proposed incentives into consideration. Second, investment dollars for Alaska will not be able to compete as effectively for investment dollars in other countries and jurisdictions. And third, sadly, with all the large land sales coming up, your bonus bids paid for the land will be commensurately reduced.
Tim, Representative Ramirez, I interrupt you for a second. What was the range of prices that you used in building your economic models for the price of oil in order for it to be economic for you to come to Alaska?
Yeah, well, I'll pass that question over to John. He's more familiar with what we did then.
At the time of entry, we were using prices in the 20 to 30, and I've done sensitivities running from $20 up to today's price.
Yeah, so at the time of our investment in 2003, if I'm not mistaken, WTI was ticking along at about $30 a barrel. But you know, our exploration costs up in Alaska, we underestimated by about half compared to where they are today. Okay, so, you know, increasing the tax and royalty take after the initial investments have been made certainly doesn't bode well to promoting this stable environment for our future commitments. In summary, Talisman is a global oil and gas producer. We've made some significant exploration investments in Alaska in the last three years, and we do have plans to invest heavily in the near term. And, of course, this is catching us not by surprise, but is going in the wrong direction because Alaska is a high-risk, high-cost exploration area. If Alaska taxes and royalties are increased, potential resources that would have been economic to explore for under the existing fiscal regime would have to be larger to attract those investment dollars. And in the exploration business, one thing's for sure, the chance of finding larger potential resources is much less than smaller potential resources. So if Alaska taxes and royalties are increased, attracting investment dollars to Alaska in competition with other jurisdictions will be more difficult. Simply put, our view is that if Alaska taxes and royalties are increased, more oil will be left in the ground. Tim. So if increasing exploration activity in order to add production for the future benefit of the Alaska people is an objective of the Alaskan government, Talisman submits this afternoon that the proposed increases in the tax and royalty structure will not serve this objective well. In closing, Talisman and its subsidiary FEX LP would like to express appreciation for the opportunity to address the House Resources Committee this afternoon and for your kind attention.
Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate that. If you could forward a copy of your testimony to Chair Samuel's office, we'd appreciate it. And let me ask you, going forward, where does your modeling put the price of oil at per barrel?
Anywhere from 20 to today's price.
Yeah, there's a volatility in the commodity price, and You know, if I knew what it was going to be 5 years out, then, you know, maybe we could have a different conversation. But it, but we do have these cycles we're working with. We are anticipating that the barrel price is going to stay positive. Perhaps not the prices we're seeing today. Perhaps growing a bit through the future. I guess our worry is that the costs are rising at an equal rate, it seems, especially up here in where we are in Alaska and the out in the remote areas. We aren't close to the service infrastructure. Our activities are going to cost us twice as much as operating close to the big fields. We don't have production in the state yet, and we're trying hard to attract the investment cash to find some resources to develop. But the size that we need now has just got larger, so it's more difficult.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Thank you very much. Thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate it. And again, if you'll get us a copy of that to Representative Samuel's office, so we can have it for the record, we'd be very appreciative.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. We have Exxon down here. Would you like to present? We'd be delighted to have you. Any graphs or charts today?
Beg your pardon? What was the question, Chairman?
I said any graphs or charts today?
None. I'd like to thank the committee for the opportunity to testify and for the late notice that we were going to testify.
Would you put your name just for the record?
Yeah, I'm going to do that. I'm Richard Owen, and I'm the production manager for ExxonMobil in Alaska and vice president of ExxonMobil Alaska Production. And I'm here today to express ExxonMobil's concerns with the proposed committee substitute to House Bill 488. Now, on February 28, I testified about our key concerns of House Bill 488 as originally proposed. And while we've not yet seen the substitute bill, we have been made aware of the key changes being considered by this committee. And in general, I would say these changes exacerbate the concerns that I described on February 28. And specifically, I'm going to make comments on two areas. The first area is around the proposal change to the tax rate, making it adjusted with price. And the second around the proposal around the reducing the transition provisions. And I'm only going to make points around those two because I think most of the other points have been covered very well in past testimony that we've given as well as other people have given today. And I would say that I'm trying, using the guidance from Representative Samuels, not to go over our previous testimony and just to tell you our current thoughts on the committee substitute provisions. So you'll find my testimony will probably be relatively short, and then I'll be happy to answer any questions. On the first area of concern, the tax rate, House Bill 488, as originally proposed, represented a dramatic tax increase for the industry. And as I previously testified, we expressed concern that the higher tax rate included in the bill could prevent some of Alaska's challenged resources from being developed. And we now understand the committee is considering even higher tax rate based on price, so above that level at different prices. We would just say that too high a tax rate does discourage investment. Companies are willing to accept the risks of long-term capital-intensive investments when there is a corresponding opportunity for upside potential through a variety of factors, such as increased production or larger reserves or higher prices. Now, when you cap or limit the benefits that companies can achieve from the upside factors, you reduce the attractiveness of those investment opportunities. The proposal to increase the already high base tax rate as prices increase does reduce or limit the upside potential and will result in the companies recalibrating how they see investment decisions. And that will lead to reduced investment and will result in reduced resource recovery, diminished state revenues and fewer employment opportunities and a negative impact on the state's economy. Chairman Ramirez, did you have a question you wanted to ask me?
I'm just in my thoughtful repose, but thank you for being so sensitive. I appreciate it, Mr. Owen.
Okay.
Thanks, sir.
Okay, well, that's all I really say about the tax rate, because I think we covered the tax rate fairly, you know, lengthy in our other testimony.
I will ask one question, if I may. I thought, because this has been a subject in this committee, and Representative Crawford, I think we've talked about this at length. I think our notion is that we're participating in the reward side, but we have yielded through the PPT, enjoying the status quo in the event that oil drops back down to 20 or 25, which is what we've heard a lot in this committee from members of the industry, is that we're at risk of oil reverting back to lower prices. So when you suggest that the model's not built on sharing at the higher end, you're not acknowledging that through PPT, the state of Alaska is offering to reduce risk for the industry at the lower prices by sacrificing the status quo through the current ELF system. Why isn't that part of your testimony?
Well, I think, Chairman Romas, if you recall back to the testimony of February 28, we saw that the increase in tax to the 20% level that we were seeing in the original proposal was the balance for the low side protection. So the low side, we were getting protected on the low side and accepting a higher tax rate of that 20%. Now, I think what the committee is proposing, although we haven't seen the details, goes beyond that with higher tax rates at higher prices. So it's different. It goes beyond what was originally proposed.
Okay. Thank you. Excuse me, Representative Seaton.
If I recalled right, you said that we capped or limited the upside potential. This isn't you're not equating this capping the upside potential like some countries where anything over a certain price, all of it goes to the government. I mean, this proposal has a cap out at $150 a barrel so that it would be a 50-50 split at $150 a barrel. Is that what you're not calling that capping, are you?
Well, Representative Seaton, and through the chair, I would say that, yeah, I've used the expression reduced or capped because we haven't seen the final details, but, yeah, to a large extent, I think we're talking about reducing the upside potential.
Okay.
Now, shifting to our second area of concern, which is the transition process or potential. ExxonMobil is concerned with the significant change from the ELF-based system to the PPT system, and the need for sufficient transition provisions to mitigate the adverse impact on recent investments. Now, we understand the committee is considering reducing those transition provisions. Now, while the benefits of a typical oil and gas investment take many years to realize, the administration's proposed a five-year transition into the higher tax PPT system, and we believe that represented a reasonable transition. The committee substitutes proposed transition provisions do not sufficiently address the significant increase in tax burden these past investments will now have to bear. Despite our concerns with House Bill 488 as originally proposed, we are prepared to move forward under that system, under House Bill 488 as originally proposed, since it sought to provide the balance of revenues to the state and the producers across a range of prices and provided sufficient incentive for producers to undertake exploration and development risks, and included a reasonable transition provisions for past investments. And most importantly for ExxonMobil, oil fiscal contract terms consistent with the administration's proposal would provide the predictability and durability necessary to advance a gas project to the next phase. And I would just reiterate from my previous testimony, it's important that the quality of the resources, the risks undertaken by the producer, and the impact on the state's overall investment climate be factored into the design of the tax system. While industry needs predictability and durability under which to gauge investment decisions, the attractiveness of that predictability and durability is lost if it comes at too high a cost. As I mentioned earlier, the committee's proposed substitute exacerbates our key concerns regarding both tax rates and transition provisions. We urge the committee to support House Bill 488 as originally proposed. I again thank the committee, the chairman, and the committee for the time allowing me to testify, and I'm happy to address any questions.
Any questions, Mr. Owen? cycle, and last has its advantages.
Just a comment.
Representative Gatto.
I was so happy to hear predictability and durability back in the equation. I almost missed it.
I'll take it that's a comment.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, with that, I believe that we are...
thank you, Mr. Owen.
Thank you.
Through. Once again, we're at the very beginning of a very still long process to go.
Go on, Mr. Chairman.
Tomorrow at 12:30, we'll try to get the CS. We still don't have the final copy of it. We'll try to get it distributed as soon as we do. And with that, we're adjourned till tomorrow. Representative Crawford.
No, go ahead.
We're adjourned.